7.5分钟开始。
Okay, let us start our next session. Professor Paul Weber voluntarily adds a fourth lecture on searching for supersymmetry particles at the LHC.
Okay, I wanted to add one more lecture in here. Get us all excited about the LHC and what the prospects are for supersymmetry, and in fact, what supersymmetry might look like at the Large Hadron Collider. So to get started here, let me remind you that in order to get started, we need a model of supersymmetry, and a particular model of supersymmetry breaking. And as I've mentioned earlier in these lectures, spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry itself is phenomenologically inconsistent within the MSSM framework. So generally, people go to what are called hidden sector models, where the hidden sector is some gauge singlet fields, although nowadays you can also hide the hidden sector in other dimensions as well. The role of the hidden sector is that it is an arena for supersymmetry breaking. So if you arrange the hidden sector such that supersymmetry or supergravity breaks, then your next step is to communicate somehow that breaking of supersymmetry from the hidden sector to the visible sector of the model. And there are three major classes of models which have emerged that give qualitatively different phenomenology. The first I've already mentioned is gravity mediation. This is the simplest because the messenger is actually gravity itself. You break supersymmetry in the hidden sector, and gravitational interactions, which always have to be present, communicate and give rise to the soft supersymmetry breaking terms. In these models, since gravity is the messenger, you call it a minimal messenger sector. And the gravitino mass is generally arranged to be at the PEV scale. And then the lightest supersymmetric particle could be the gravitino, or if the gravitino is sufficiently decoupled or heavy, it could be the typically the Beano, Higgsino, Wieno mixture, which would be the lightest nucleino. Another possibility is gauge-mediated supersymmetry. In this model, you have a hidden sector and a visible sector, but instead of having SUSY breaking communicated via gravity, now you introduce specific messenger fields. And these messenger fields, they couple to the hidden sector, and then they also couple to the visible sector. And so they mediate, you can calculate the soft SUSY breaking terms from messenger particles. And in these models, generally, the gravitino mass M3 has is taken to be much less than the PEV scale. And so the lightest SUSY particle is always a very light gravitino. Third class is anomaly mediation models. These are models where the soft terms arise from violations of the superconformal anomaly. And these have been formulated typically as extra dimensional models where you put the hidden sector on a different brain, so it's really very hidden. It's usually called a sequestered sector. And then the soft SUSY breaking terms are all proportional to the beta functions of the RGEs. And as a result, the lightest SUSY particle, well, M3 halves the gravitino mass is generally much bigger than a PEV. It's around 10 to 100 PEV. but the light of Suzy particle turns out to be a pure Wienel state. Now, these are all very highly speculative models, and their main role is that they present three very different phenomenological pictures of what can happen, and a lot of that phenomenology is dictated by which particle, what type of particle is the light of Suzy particle. Well, if you want to worry about what supersymmetry is going to look like at the LHC, then you have to go ahead and adopt one of these models and go ahead and calculate all the spectra. And once you know the spectra and the mixings of the particle states, you have to calculate all the production cross-sections for every possible reaction at the LHC, and you have to calculate all the decay modes. And then you have to go ahead and see what the scattering events are going to look like. It turns out a lot of this material is embedded in the program IsaJet and a sub-program of IsaJet called IsaSugra, which will calculate the spectra for you and the branching fractions of all the particles. So within IsaJet, if you run the IsaSugra program, you can either input an MSSM model with all weak scale inputs. This has no renormalization group running. Or you can input a variety of other models, which do include renormalization group running. Minimal supergravity model, which has the parameter space I talked about. Or non-universal supergravity models, which have a larger set of parameters in here. Gauge-mediated Suzy breaking, if you input these parameters. This M here is a messenger scale. That's the scale at which the theory becomes the correct effective theory. So really, you run the RGEs from the messenger scale down to the Suzy scale. And lambda is a characteristic mass scale of the Suzy particles. N5 is the number of messengers. And this thing basically governs how long-lived the next lightest Suzy particle is when it decays in the gravitino. So there's minimal and non-minimal gauge mediation models. And then there's a minimal and non-minimal anomaly mediation model. And then finally, with the latest IsaJet, there's something called mixed modulus anomaly-mediated Suzy breaking models. This is a string-inspired model from Kapru, Kalash, Linde, and Trivedi that where the soft terms have both gravity-mediated component and anomaly-mediated component, similar strengths. So you can pick the model and run the program and input appropriate parameters, and it'll calculate all the spectra. I showed this slide before. They do all the running, minimize the effective potential down at the weak scale, and then put all the one-loop radiative corrections in and the leading two-loop corrections in the Higgs masses. And along with IsaJet, there's three other codes that do similar stuff. And on the web page only compares the minimal supergravity model, but most of these codes have many of those other models that I just mentioned. So once you know what the spectra is like, then you have to go ahead and check that you obey all these constraints. And if you are indeed obeying all the constraints, then you've got a point that maybe you want to inspect in the parameter space of one of these models. So I showed a picture like this earlier. This is the M0 versus M1/2 plane, showing different allowed regions that the constraints give for the minimal supergravity model. So in this case, you'd want to pick points along here to see what supersymmetry looks like at the LHC, or along the green edge over here, or up in this area. Luckily, in the latest IsaJet versions, it also calculates all those constraints as well, including the relative density. So you can dump out all that information as well. Now, once you've got a valid parameter space point, then the next situation is that you want to see what sort of supersymmetric particles get produced at an accelerator like the LHC, and at what rates they get produced, so that you can know what to look for. So in this case, we have to go ahead and adopt the partonic model for hadronic reactions. If you've got a hadrons A and B colliding to make particles C and D in the final state, plus assorted hadronic debris, what you have to do first is calculate the associated subprocess reaction, little a plus little b goes to C plus D, which is some sort of calculable cross-section in perturbation theory. So the subprocess cross-section we can calculate using the Lagrangian for the MSSM, and then to obtain the final cross-section, for instance, proton plus proton goes to spork plus gluino, then you have to go ahead and convolute the appropriate subprocess cross-section, d sigma hat, with the parton distribution functions, f that gives the distribution of parton A and hadron big A at fractional momentum x sub A in energy scale q squared, and then another one for parton B and hadron big B. So you have to do that convolution and do a two-dimensional integral to find the cross-section. So in the results I'm going to show, we always use the CTEC 5L parton distribution function. So one of the first things you might want to look at is chargino-neutralino production at the LHC. This is actually turns out to be usually the dominant cross-section of the tevatron for gravity-mediated Suzy braking models. So this would make a chargino in association with a neutralino, and it turns out there's not just one of these reactions, but since there's two charginos and six neutralinos, you actually get six of these reactions that you have to calculate, and they can proceed via W exchange in the S channel, or D left exchange, or U left spark exchange in the T channel. Okay, so once you calculate these things, actually in the book that I mentioned in my earlier lectures, we go through the calculation explicitly, including how to handle the Majorana fields here. Frequently in your initial quantum field theory course, you never hear about Majorana fields, but here you have them. These things have their own unique field expansion because you have to obey the constraint that the particle is equal to its conjugate. And so you have to go ahead and plug in appropriately these field operators and derive the scattering amplitude and then square it and turn it into a subprocess cross-section. I'm not going to go through that calculation here, but you can find it in the book on weak scale supersymmetry if you like. Once you do get the subprocess cross-section and convolute, then you have to go ahead and plot the cross-sections out. And here's an example of these cross-sections. These cross-sections all assume the Gugino mass unification relation. If the Gugino masses are unified up at the gut scale, then at the weak scale, Gugino mass M1 over alpha 1, alpha 1 is the fine structure constant for the U1 group, is equal to M2 over alpha 2 is equal to M3 over alpha 3, due to the fact that these Gugino masses have the same beta similar beta functions to the gauge couplings. So I can go ahead and calculate all these cross-sections in terms of M gluino, because if I know M gluino, that's the same as M3 at 3 level, then I can calculate what, I know what alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3 are, so I can calculate what M1 and M2 are. Then I just need to stipulate mu, and so mu is equal to M gluino, and that's equal to M squark, then I have all the inputs needed to calculate a cross-section. So, as a matter of fact, these constraints are what we frequently will see in gravity-mediated Suzy braking models. So these plots basically pertain to gravity-mediated Suzy braking. Actually, they also pertain to gauge mediation, because gauge mediation also preserves that Gaetano mass unification relationship. This is the Gluino mass in the bottom scale. The y-axis is the cross-section in femtobarns. And remember, Paru said that one of the target integrated luminosities that the LHC is shooting for is to, in the first several years, to try to amass about 100 inverse femtobarns of integrated luminosity. So that means after several years, you can multiply any of these cross-section numbers by 100, and that would be the number of events that you'd expect at the LHC for any of these reactions. So immediately from this plot, I could say, well, if the Gluino is 500 GeV, then I'd read off a cross-section here of around 3 times 10 to the 3 femtobarns. That would give me 3 times 10 to the 5th events expected at the LHC, or 300,000 events. So using this relation, you find that Chargino 1, Neutralino 2 is by far the dominant of these 6 cross-sections, and all these other cross-sections. Well, the next dominant one is Chargino 1, Neutralino 1, and then the other ones are quite a lot smaller in strength. Actually, this cross-section, this reaction is quite nice, because if Chargino's and Neutralino's decay via 3 bodies, and their decays are dominated by the W and Z boson, this production reaction gives rise to a trilepton signature plus missing energy, which is hard to generate in the standard model, and so it's a possible channel where you may have a decent signal to background ratio. Okay, you could also imagine producing a pair of Chargino's. These things occur through gamma and Z exchange in the S channel, or U left tilde spork exchange. If you plot them on the same plot, Chargino 1 plus Chargino 1 minus is the dominant cross section. The other ones are quite small. It's because Chargino 2 becomes Higgsino-like, and it doesn't couple very strongly to the vector bosons, but these guys do, and so they have a much bigger cross section. And again, for 500 GeV Gluino, you have, again, about 3 times 10 to the 3 femtobarns of cross section. You can also make pairs of Neutralinos. If you set I here equal to 1, then you'd make Z1, Z1 tilde. That'd be just 2 dark matter particles, and you'd get nothing in your detector, aside from initial state radiation off the sporks. But if I or J is not equal to 1, then you'll get visible signatures from these reactions. These reactions all occur through Z exchange, or spork left, or spork right exchange. But since it ends up that the cross sections are all rather small, here you can see for 500 GeV Gluino, the dominant one is Neutralino 2, Neutralino 2 production, and that only occurs at about a 30 femtobarn cross section. So they're not real big. You can also make slepton pairs at the LHC. Left bar sleptons, so this would be E left bar, or U left bar, or Stau 1, Stau 2 bar, etc. You make either left or right pairs, neutrinos, or you can make sleptons neutrino pair production via W exchange. If you make neutrino pair production, frequently the neutrinos will decay visibly into electron plus chargino. So these wouldn't necessarily be invisible particles that you're making. Even though neutrinos would be visible, the neutrinos can decay to visible particles. here's the cross-sections for Slepton pair production versus the Slepton mass. Even if you go out to 100 GV in the Slepton mass, this cross-section is, this is in actually picobarn units now, so I have to go, if this was one femtobarn, I'd go to 10. These are about 20, 30 femtobarn cross-sections for 100 GV Slepton. They're not real huge cross-sections. And Slepton pairs are generally pretty tough to see. Actually, this is for the Tevatron, sorry. Here's the LHC. So 100 would give you about 400 or 500 femtobarn cross-sections. These types of particles you can generally see up to masses of about 300 GV at the LHC, and much beyond that, the cross-sections get quite tiny and they're very hard to pick out from the background. Now you can move on to things like galeno pair production. If you make a pair of galenos, they can get produced via gluon-gluon fusion through these three diagrams here, or from quark-antiquark annihilation via these three diagrams here. One of the wonderful things about galenos is that these guys are Majorana particles. So they decay to a quark plus a, they might decay to a QQ bar plus a chargine or something like that. They, each galeno can decay to the same sign chargino, and if you get chargino plus production, then you get, and the charginos decay to leptons, you get same sign dileptons coming out of the galeno pair event. Here's lots of diagrams for squirt pair production. It turns out there's a rather large number of diagrams via glue-glue annihilation or QQ or QQ bar annihilation. It turns out there's many different combinations of squirts you can make. You can make U left, U right, U left, U right bar, U left, D right. There's many, many combinations, and so lots and lots of reactions that you have to keep track of for squirt pair production, and each flavor of squirt has different decay modes. And then you can also make squirt galeno-associated production. That is, you can have gluon quark annihilation through galeno or squirt exchange to make squirt and a galeno simultaneously in the final state. So all these are all strongly interacting particle production cross-sections. And so you can go ahead and see how these guys get produced. Now if I go to 500 GeV galeno and I look up the plot here, I've got cross-sections that are of order 10 to the 5th femtobarn. So that's really a huge cross-section. And then you'd expect 10 million of those events in 100 inverse femtobarns. So if galenos and squirts are relatively white, then you've got tremendously big cross-sections for these guys. And so usually the dominant production cross-section is going to be to make these strongly interacting 2D particles at the LHC. Well, you can go ahead and compare all these cross-sections. Here are different cross-sections, again, versus M. galeno, the cross-sections in femtobarns. This is for the Tevatron, so this is root S equals 2 TeV. This line here is, I take a value of M. galeno just under 400 GeV, then I can calculate the chargino mass. It turns out to be 103 GeV, so below this line is excluded by left, and above the line is open territory. You see at the Tevatron, chargino pair production and chargino neutralino is really going to be the dominant one. Galenos and squirts are going to be far subdominant, and it's mainly because partly because these guys are so suppressed because they're quite a bit more massive than the chargino. Okay, so at the Tevatron, you're going to be mainly making Chargino and Neutralino pairs. At the LHC, you can make a similar plot. And here is the Gluino and Squark sum cross section. Here's Charginos and Neutralinos. You can see at the LHC, the Gluinos and Squarks are by far dominant. All the way out to, in this case, with M Squark equal to M Gluino, they dominate out to about 1600-1700 GeV in the Gluino mass. If you make Squarks twice the Gluino mass, then these Squarks are much heavier and they start decoupling, and that suppresses the strongly interacting particle cross-section. Then you can look at that case, and Gluino and Squark pair production is only dominant out to about 800 GeV in the Gluino mass. So if Squarks are extremely heavy, then you might actually have, again, Chargino-Neutralino production, which is dominant. M Gluino is bigger than 800 GeV. Okay, well, there's more production reactions. I'm not going to show you too many because you get too bored. You could also make Gluinos in association with Charginos, or Gluinos in association with Neutralinos, or Squarks in association with Charginos, or Squarks with Neutralinos. And those are all usually somewhat suppressed relative to the direct strong of the interacting particle production. But once you know how the particles are produced, then you got to worry about what happens to them. And so in the case of a Gluino, the Gluinos, if their mass is bigger than the Squark mass, then they can decay via two-body motion, a Quark-Squark. For instance, Gluino can decay to a U-left tilde bar, or a U-bar U-left tilde, or something like that. However, if Squarks are lighter than the Gluino mass, if Squarks are heavier than the Gluino mass, then this two-body mode is closed, and the Gluinos have to decay via three-body modes. And they can decay into QQ bar Chargino via these diagrams, or QQ bar Neutralino via these diagrams. And again, they can decay into Chargino 1 or Chargino 2 or Neutralino 1, 2, 3, or 4. So there are lots of different decay modes for these Gluinos, and they can also decay into the top and bottom pairs and things like that. Here's some sample Gluino branching fractions that I've calculated. Again, over here it's versus M Gluino, ranging from 200 GeV to 1000 GeV. And what I've done is I've taken the mu parameter to be fixed at 200 GeV, tan beta equal to 5, M squared equal to 1 GeV. And so when I'm at relatively low Gluino masses, the Gluinos can decay to Chargino 1 plus QQ bar, Neutralino 2, Neutralino 1. As the Gluino mass increases, its mass gets bigger than Chargino 2 and Neutralino 4 and Neutralino 3. And these other modes start turning on. They can decay to QQ bar Chargino 2, QQ bar Chargino, Neutralino 4, or Neutralino 3. And so then these guys also will decay. And so you get lengthy cascade decays possible from these Gluinos. They can decay to one SUSY particle plus standard model particles, which will decay to another SUSY particle until you finally reach the state with the lightest SUSY particle. So you may end up getting a Gluino decay event that contains many jets, possibly isolated leptons from the Chargino Neutralino decay, plus missing energy all the time. You can see when you get up here to 1000 GeV, then all of a sudden Gluino can decay via two-body mode into Quark-Squark. That mode turns on and dominates the branching fraction. If instead you plot these branching fractions versus tan beta, some interesting effects occur. As tan beta increases, the B-Quark-Yukawa coupling increases as well, and that enhances the Gluino's ability to decay into B-Quarks. And so at low tan beta, the Gluino is going to dominantly decay into QQ bar, TT bar, and other QQ bar channels. But as tan beta increases, the BB bar mode increases and increases until finally, another thing that happens as tan beta increases is if the B quark your power coupling increases, it helps push the bead squark mass down, and then ultimately the Galeno becomes heavier than the bottom squark, or rather the bottom squark becomes lighter than the Galeno, and then this two-body mode turns on, so the Galeno can stay at the bottom to the bottom. So at large tangent beta, you expect your Suzy events to be really filled with lots of bead jets and lots of third generation particles, which will give you lots of bead jets, which you can possibly detect via displaced vertices. Now, how about squarks? How do they decay? Well, squarks should always decay via two-body modes. They could decay, a U left can decay into U plus any four of the neutralinos, that's why I put an index I here, or D plus the two chargenos if they're kinematically allowed, or into a U quark plus a Galeno if that's kinematically allowed. Likewise, the D left can have similar decay modes. The right-handed squarks, they do not couple to chargenos at all, so they're going to have a subset of these modes. They're only going to decay the neutralinos or the Galenos if they're allowed, but they don't have any chargeno decay. So here's a branching fraction. You probably can't see this label down here. It's MU left tilde, ranging from 200 GeV to over 1,000 GeV. And as I increase the U left tilde mass, here's the branching fractions. For very light squark masses, the squark decays to U plus neutralino 1, 100%. As the squark mass increases, more decay modes open up, and it starts decaying into all of a sudden D chargeno, U neutralino 2, and then as it gets heavier, it can decay into D chargeno 2, U neutralino 3, and U neutralino 4, and then ultimately out here, it gets to where it can decay into Galeno. Now the right squarks, here's the right squark, it decays dominantly into U plus neutralino 1, and this actually stays the dominant channel all throughout this mass range of the squark. And what that means is from right-handed squarks, you're dominantly going to get a really hard U-quark jet plus missing energy, so it's a relatively simple signature, whereas the left-handed squarks, they're going to decay through lengthy cascade decays, through multi-step cascades, so there you get a bigger jet multiplicity, but the jets will be softer, and the missing energy should be softer as well. Now, if you have sleptons that get produced in your collider, you have to worry about how they decay as well. And they also decay via two-body modes. E left can decay to electron neutralino or neutrino chargeno. The neutrinos can decay to neutralino neutrino or electron chargeno. If this guy is neutralino number one, then this is a completely invisible decay mode. All the other decay modes are quite visible. And then E right can only decay to E plus neutralino 1, 2, 3, or 4. So here's the selectron decay modes versus M E left. And again, they dominantly decay to E neutralino 1 at low slepton masses. But as the slepton mass increases, all these other decay modes open up and they become comparable and even dominant. For the E right, again, it dominantly decays to E neutralino 1. As it gets heavier, E neutralino 2 opens up and takes some of the branching fraction, but dominantly it goes to E neutralino 1 over the whole mass range. And neutrinos, if they're extremely light, then they're only going to decay into neutralino 1. But if they get heavier, then they could decay into some of these heavier neutralinos and chargenos, and then all these visible modes start opening up as well. Now, you might make these chargenos either directly as two-to-two reactions, or you can make the chargenos via the cascade decays. They could come from squark or Galeno decays, or slepton decays even. And the chargenos can decay to W neutralino, or charge takes neutralino, or to quark squark modes, or to lepton slepton modes, if any of these are open. If these modes are all closed, then the Chargino decays via three body modes into neutralino plus fermion, antifermion. And here are the Feynman diagrams. Turns out there's five diagrams that Chargino can decay through. If you put in the E left, E right, E1, E2, and W and charge pigs diagrams. Now, again, as tangent beta gets large, the tau-u-tau coupling also gets large. And if the tau-u-tau coupling is large, then if this electron is really a tau, then you've got an enhanced u-tau coupling here, and that enhances at large tan beta the Chargino decay into tau states. So again, at large tan beta, not only do you expect feed jets in your cascade decay events, but you also expect a much higher multiplicity of tau jets. Now taus, if you make them and they decay hadronically, they usually decay into one prong or three charged prongs. And so you get a jet coming out with either just one or three prongs. And these are relatively straightforward to identify because your usual QCD jets that come from gluon or quark production have much, much higher multiplicities of charged particles in them. Neutralinos, if you make them, they can decay via two body modes into W Chargino, charge Higgs Chargino, Z boson neutralino, Higgs boson neutralino. This is an especially exciting mode because if you make make neutralinos at the LHC, they may decay into this light Higgs boson, and of course the neutralinos get produced in the squark cascade decays, and the squarks and gluinos get made at tremendous rates if they're light enough. Then you'll be making these Higgs bosons, not directly through all the reactions Karu talked about, but you'll be making them as byproducts of the cascade decays of the gluinos and squarks, where the neutralinos decay into Higgs bosons. They can also decay into quark, squark, or lepton-slepton pairs. If all these two-body modes are somehow closed off because they're not kinematically allowed, then the neutralino can decay into neutralino, a lighter neutralino, plus fermion, anti-fermion pair through these eight diagrams here. And these E's can stand for E mu or tau, or you can replace them by quark, anti-quark as well. Again, at large tan beta, since the B quark u-tau coupling gets big, this could be a BB bar pair here, and you'll get neutralino decays to BB bar, or it can be a tau lepton pair, and you get enhanced decays in tau tau bar as well. Okay, so these sparticle cascade decays turn out to be, there's many, many, many possibilities. Here is a chart, which is probably, again, hard to read. This is a mass scale over on this side, and this bottom is branching fraction, ranging from 10 to the minus 2 up to 100%. And this is the gluino up here, and it shows you the number of ways the gluino can cascade decay. This is for a 2-TeV gluino. At first, it decays into, each of these lines is a decay mode, so you got 1, 2, 3, or five decay modes. But once you decay into those heavier, those other particles have numerous other decays that they can undergo. And by the time you count up all the number of paths that this gluino can take to get to the lightest UV particle, you get quite a huge plethora of decay modes. And it gets a little bit hard to think about exactly how this gluino is going to manifest itself at a hadron collider. Not only that, but you've got hundreds of Suzy particle reactions. If I put in all the different flavors and stuff, there's production reactions, I get several hundred of them. And then I've got tremendous numbers of decay modes. So how do you make sense of all this stuff? How do you see what Suzy looks like? Well, it turns out that for the LHC, really the way to look for, to see what Suzy would look like is to embed all this stuff in an event generator program. Event generator programs are computer programs that simulate particle scattering. So in our case for the LHC, we're going to have proton-proton scattering. For clarity, I got both these protons coming in the same direction. So you can flip this guy around if you like it the other way. So what happens here is I've broken down the event generation into distinct steps. Number one occurs in this blue circle here. That's your sub-process cross-section. In this case, you've got gluon quark scattering to make a gluino and a quark. So you have to calculate that and convolute it with the parton distribution functions, as I mentioned earlier. Now, step two is, it turns out, if you really want to get a realistic picture of what these events look like, you have to worry about these initial state particles. You've got a bunch of quarks and gluons in the initial state. And quarks and gluons, since they're strongly interacting, they love to radiate off other quarks and gluons as well. And normally this might be intractable because QCD is a rather difficult theory, but a way was found to calculate this thing, and what it's called is a parton shower. Basically what you can do is if you generate a quark or a gluon, you can calculate in a probabilistic fashion what the probability is to emit a quark or gluon at a certain energy and transverse momentum. And the algorithm was originally developed by Fox and Wolfram back in 1979, and it's been fine-tuned a little bit by some other authors. But basically, it allows you to calculate how many quarks and gluons get radiated by the initial state or the final state particles. And that gives you some idea of jet broadening and multi-jet production in QCD events. In this case, what people do is they use the matrix elements, an approximate matrix element, squared matrix element, to calculate these k probabilities. The squared matrix element is exact in the limit that the quarks and gluons are collinear. And that's the most important region because there's a singularity in the cross-section for quark and gluon emission in the collinear regime. So you get the matrix element right in the most important regime, but as you get quark or gluon emission at higher transverse momenta, so it's not the collinear regime, then the matrix element gets off more and more, and so you're getting a worse and worse approximation to QCD for the high angle emissions of these things. Well, you can construct an algorithm for that, and that's embedded in all the event generator programs. At that point, you also have to go ahead and calculate the quark and gluino decays, and if you calculate a whole decay table, then you can throw a random number and then go ahead and let it pick the decay modes in a probabilistic fashion. As a matter of fact, you also go ahead and calculate all the production cross-sections and throw a random number to generate the more probabilistic cross-sections as well. At that stage, you've got lots of particles, but they're quarks and gluons, and you don't see quarks and gluons in a detector. What you see are things like pions and kaons. So the next stage is hadronization, and there you have to field some hadronization model. The simplest model was Field and Feynman's model of independent hadronization from back in 1978. In the early 80s, the Lund string model was developed, which also accounts for color flow information. And then in a little bit later in the 1980s, a cluster hadronization model was developed by Weber and Marchesini, which is an improvement over the string model. And then the last step here, so at that point, if you've got an algorithm, these are sort of phenomenological Kund models because hadronization is not a perturbative process. So then you can turn all these quarks and gluons into pions and kaons and protons and things like that, which you do know how they're supposed to interact in your detector. At that point, you still have the beam remnants. For instance, if a quark scatters here, then you still have two quarks from this proton. And those remnants, you have to figure out what happens to them. They generally give you a big, hard jet going in the direction of the beam line, but some of that energy can leak out, so you get deposits of energy, especially in the forward and backward region. from the beam remnants, and there's different models for modeling how those beam remnants evolve. So for supersymmetry, there's three codes that are available. IsaJet, this is the first all-purpose generator developed, and so it uses the older versions of hadronization models. Fox Wolfram Parton Showers and N-Cut Tomaron model for underlying events. Pythiad by Sjostrand has string hadronization, Fox Wolfram Parton Showers, a multiple scattering model for the underlying event. But its supersymmetry is only valid at low tan beta because they neglect these power couplings in these decay mechanisms. And then Herwig by Marchesini and Weber and other collaborators now uses a cluster hadronization model. They use an angle-ordered parton shower model that's supposed to account for some additional QCD effects, and then a phenomenological model for the underlying event. And they actually use the IsaJet calculation of all the decay branching ratios to input in to tell their SUVI particles how to decay. So once you've got this thing, then you can actually run the computer code and see what these supersymmetry events are going to look like. And usually you want to run many of them to see what they all look like. This is a simulation of the CMS detector where you've got I forget what the particles are being produced in here, but it is a event with three leptons plus two jets. You can see the jets blasting out this way and this way. One of these jets, jet one, is 237 GeV, jet two is 339 GeV. The neutralinos have 190 GeV and 95 GeV. The leptons, you got a muon of 55 GeV, another muon of 44, and another electron of 43.9 GeV. So you've got three leptons, two jets, plus lots of missing energy. That's an event that would stand out very well against standard model backgrounds. Okay, so then you can go ahead and see, at that point, what you've got is a program that will map your parameter space up at, for instance, at the gut scale. It's going to map gut scale physics, essentially, through the renormalization group equations, all the scattering cross-section decay rates, and maps it onto energy depositions in your calorimeter. So now you've got a tool that'll actually map the gut scale physics into detector depositions, and you can see what you're going to get at the LHC, for instance. So at the LHC, as I said, Galeno and Squark production is dominant for Squark masses and less than about a TeV. You get lengthy cascade decays, and you get events with jets plus missing energy, jets plus missing energy plus one isolated lepton, or events with two opposite sign isolated leptons, or two same sign isolated leptons, for instance, from Galeno pair production, three leptons, four leptons, and then these events will typically have large ET missing plus jets. So you can classify all these event topologies, and then you have to go ahead and calculate all the backgrounds to see whether the signal sticks out above background or whether it's swamped by background. So generally, to get these high ET missing, high jet multiplicity events, you have to calculate standard model processes like W plus multi-jet production, Z plus multi-jet production, TT bar production, BB bar production, W pair production, 4W production, 4 top production, stuff like that. And then you have to go ahead and try to find for your given parameter space point what sort of cuts, what requirements you can put on these events in order to give you optimized signal to background. So as an exercise in the minimal supergravity model, we did this thing requiring missing energy bigger than 200 GeV, number of jets bigger than 2, where a jet has to have TT bigger than 40 GeV, And then at that point, you have to really optimize cups for different parts of parameter space. If you're at low M0, low M1/2 region, particles are quite light and you produce them at huge rates. So then relatively soft missing energy and jet cups are good for seeing SUSY. If you go to extremely heavy particle masses, then the production cross-sections are low, but the particle masses are so high they give really high energy jets and high ET missing. Then you want to use really high ET missing and high ET jet cuts. So it helps to have a grid that's optimized all over parameter space. And then usually what people do is for a given integrated luminosity, they require that the signal should exceed 5 times the square root of background to get some sort of observability criteria. So you can do this all over parameter space, and so every point in this parameter space on some grid was generated events, and then they were separated out into categories, and then contours were made. Below the contour, you can see a specific event class. Up here is ET missing plus jets. Here's one lepton plus jets, option sign dilepton plus jets, etc. So for 100 inverse femtobarns, you should be able to see SUSY in these channels underneath each of these contours. Just for scale, this green line here gives a spork mass of 2 TeV, and the blue line gives a galeno mass of 2 TeV. So it turns out for 100 inverse femtobarns, over in this area of parameter space, sporks and galenos are nearly the same mass. And you can see spork and galeno mass is up to about 3 TeV up there for 100 inverse femtobarns of integrated luminosity. If you go over here to the focus point region, sporks are around 4 to 5 TeV. They basically decouple, and all you're making are galeno pairs and carginos and neutrinos. Then you can only see SUSY up to galeno masses of about 1.8 TeV. These results pretty much hold over many different values of PAN data, and actually different SUSY models, as long as you got the same type of decay signatures. They mainly depend on the spork and galeno masses, and then if you modify the cascade decays, they don't grossly change these signal rates typically. Well, I showed this plot the other day. This is sort of a compendium of the ultimate reach of the LHC, just for 100 inverse femtobarns. You go up to 200 or 500 or 1,000 inverse femtobarns. Obviously, this reach is going to increase. The green regions are the dark matter allowed areas. And for perspective, I also show the Tevatron reach down here. This is the Tevatron reach for 10 inverse femtobarns. Right now, they got about 1 inverse femtobarn. So this is sort of the ultimate reach of the Tevatron in the clean trileptron channel for making carginoneutrino production. Linear collider, if you build a linear collider of 500 GeV, you can see everything under this black contour. Basically, under this part of the contour, you can make Chargino pair production. Under this little blip here, you can make neutralino 1, neutralino 2 production and see it above the background. And under this thing, you can see slepton pair production. And here's a 1 TeV linear collider reach. So the linear colliders have generally a lower reach for SUSY. Their main purpose is that if you find supersymmetry, they can really do precision measurements on masses and spins and things like that. But they do have a bigger reach for SUSY up here in this focus point region. Okay, well, once you've discovered supersymmetry, suppose you've got a whole host of events with jets and missing energy and leptons in them, then what you want to do, you actually won't know if that's supersymmetry or some other model that gives the same thing. But then you want to do is try to play with those events, make various distributions, and extract out quantities that might have some relation to the superparticle masses, or to prove that it's really supersymmetry and not some other type of new physics. So there's lots of things that can be done. One thing Frank Page recommends is plotting an effective mass variable. This is just a simple thing. You take the ET missing in the event and add it to this with a scalar sum to the ET of jet 1, plus ET of jet 2 plus ET jet 3 plus ET of jet 4 for events with 4 jets at least plus missing energy. And then if you plot out this distribution against background, you generally get something that looks like this. The signal is these white circles here, and the background is this histogram from all sorts of standard model processes. Generally, when you go to big enough M effective, the signal emerges from the background, and typically it has a peak that is associated with the rough range of the spark and luminal masses. So if you made a distribution like this, and you saw the peak was around 1200 GeV, then you'd say, well, this looks like it's something that's making 1200 GeV spark and luminal pairs. So that gives you a rough estimate of what you're making. Now, you can also do other things. One of the best things you can do is if you've made neutralino 2 pairs, or neutralino 2 in your event, and neutralino 2 decays into lepton, anti-lepton, neutralino 1. Dileptons are usually easy to see. Again, opposite sign isolated dileptons. In this case, kinematics would dictate that the dilepton invariant mass is less than neutralino 2 minus neutralino 1. So if you go ahead and look for these types of events, then you would get a distribution that looks like this. This is for a particular point in parameter space. This M is MLL bar down here. And in this case, the neutralino mass difference is about 100 GeV. And so what you see is that you get a distribution with a very sharp cutoff here, and this kinematic cutoff gives you information on the mass gap between these two guys. You can't actually get an absolute mass very easily from these superparticle events because neutralino 1 is always missing. It goes shooting off out of your detector, it's unmeasured, and so the kinematics won't allow you to construct the exact neutralino 2 mass, but you can get neutralino 2 minus neutralino 1 mass difference. In a similar vein, you could go ahead and take those events. If you had a squark that decayed to quark plus neutralino 2, and neutralino 2 decayed to those two leptons, you could take those two leptons plus the closest jet and make a distribution of all the events that look like that. Then again, you get some sort of a cutoff which is related to the squark mass minus neutralino 1 mass, and that might give you some sort of estimate of a squark mass, or at least a squark neutralino mass difference. Okay. Here's another thing you can do. It turns out if the Higgs boson is around 115 to 135 GeV, Karu Hagiwara told you it's going to take about 3-4 years before you can even discover it in that mass range, because the best mode, it usually pays the BB bar, but you're swamped under a huge QCD background of BB bar production. So in fact, you have to look for Higgs goes to gamma-gamma, which only occurs 0.3% of the time or so, and then look for that against the photon-photon background from QCD, and if you've got a good enough electromagnetic calorimeter, you can look for a teensy bump against this big background and get the Higgs mass. However, if supersymmetric particles are there and you're making squarks and gluinos at the rate of a million events per year, then those squarks and gluinos may be decaying into neutralino 2, which decays into a Higgs boson. Then all you do is you take your jets plus missing energy events, you might have a million of them, and then you start looking for BB bar mass bumps in there. For that kind, you'll have a very small standard model background, because normally you don't make a BB bar pair with huge jet multiplicity and huge ET missing. So here's some supersymmetry events where you look for the BB bar mass bump, and sure enough, there it is around in this simulation, it was about 95 GeV, and so you get a nice pig's mass bump that sticks out above the standard model and the Suzy background. Standard model background's way down here. This is other supersymmetric processes. So you can see the Higgs, you may well discover the Higgs first is a byproduct of these supersymmetry events. Then in direct Higgs production. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what supersymmetry might look like at the LHC. There's a variety of Suzy models. I only talked about the minimal supergravity model, but if you've got some of those other models, the gauge mediation models, they generally give you hard photons in the events. For anomaly mediation, actually, it looks a lot like minimal supergravity from a collider standpoint. So all these allowed regions in WMAP that are WMAP allowed give rise to distinct signatures, and it's fun to look at different points in the allowed region to see what supersymmetry looks like at the LHC. So hopefully I gave you some idea of what supersymmetry will look like at the LHC. Okay, thank you.
No questions? Will be interested in asking the question of detecting Suzy particles. Any questions? Okay, if there's no question, then thank you. We have a 5-minute break for changing the recording tape. Let's come back to the conference room in 5 minutes.